Welcome to the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Morgan Housel reminds us that the highest form of wealth is waking up every morning and being able to do exactly what it is that you want to do. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at consumer confidence numbers out of South Africa. Consumers continue to be under pressure with the rising cost of inflation and cost of living not coming down anytime soon. We take a look at that with independent economist John Lewis and get his thoughts on how it is that that situation could potentially be changed. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the impact of the US-Iran conflict on local and global markets and perhaps how it has influenced the global outlook from an investor standpoint with the team at the Bureau for Market Research. We also have a conversation with our aviation expert, Dr. Guy Leach, on Air Europa announcing that effective from tomorrow, they will be launching a long-haul flight between Johannesburg and Madrid. We take a look at Wimbledon 2026. Wimbledon debenture prices have more than tripled in the last 2 years. We try and make sense of the numbers and the economics behind that and see if we can figure out where that puts that particular business beyond its sporting appeal. And then we wrap up the show, as we do every other Tuesday, with a property conversation. We're going to be taking a look at home improvements and the personalization trend that seems to be emerging there.
The day's markets. Clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Managing Director at Wealth Strat, Victoria Ruvers, to take a look at market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Victoria, lovely having you on our show. Thanks so much for taking the time. A sea of red from an equity perspective, a huge sell-off, not just in local markets, but international markets all the way through to US markets. What has markets jittery?
Well, yeah, tough day on the markets indeed. So our market down almost 2%. And I think it really imported a lot of the sell-off that started in Asian markets. So, you know, some of the big tech darlings, sort of SK Hynix, Samsung, all down around 12% early as we started the day. And as we're seeing in the US this morning, Nvidia's down, SpaceX down, all the big tech companies really driving it. And I think what you're starting to see is a lot more talk from analysts about the sort of potential AI bubble and just trying to see whether these valuations are justified based on the fundamentals and the earnings. So we've seen solid earnings to date, but the levels at prices of these companies are just sort of eye-watering to some degree.
Victoria, let's take a look at some of those movements. The SpaceX numbers at the moment, SpaceX trading as low as $146 a share earlier today. We're at about $162, seemingly some signs of recovery there. But the sentiment there from a market perspective, very, very telling of perhaps some nervousness within the markets, perhaps in the AI conversation. You alluded to Nvidia as well. How are you seeing the AI trade at the moment? It has been all the rage beyond all the other, or over and above all the other market movements this year.
Yeah, I mean, the SpaceX is an interesting one. So our listeners will be familiar with this, that it listed just over 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago. And in the last three trading days, and it listed at 150, and that's now sitting at like 147, it's wiped out over $600 billion in market value over the last three trading sessions. So it's actually looking like it's going to fall below the $2 trillion valuation. And, you know, again, for our listeners, $600 billion, that's more than most countries produce in a year. So it's a really, really big number. And I think just part of that pressure right now on SpaceX is also due to the 20 billion rand bond issuance that they're looking to raise. But I think we're going to look back in time because, as you know, SpaceX has been so spoken about. Yes, there's a profitable business there in the rocket side of the business, but also people are betting so much on economies that don't actually exist right now. And so the reality is there's so much exuberance and hype, and there's been a lot of retail money, and a lot of people have borrowed money from the retail side to invest in this huge AI boom. And I think the market, it was starting to catch up with itself. So who knows if and when there's a top of the market. As I say, there's still very strong earnings from companies that are producing, that actually are making money out of this. But there's also a lot of hype and a lot of excitement chasing false dreams.
Victoria, can we take a look at the US dollar index, the dollar basket, for the first time this year trading above 100 points. That clear indication that even those that are looking at the US conversation are wanting the peace deal to go ahead. This is the strongest, as I said, that we've seen the dollar index since, I want to say, this sometime last year, towards the tail end of last year. We've struggled to even break above 100 points and sustain. At this rate, the market clearly showing the US investors, at least, that peace is good for the market.
Yeah, and I mean, I think everybody wants this war to end pretty much. But if the war can end and inflation can come down, then that's obviously good for interest rates. And what we've seen is the hawkish stance from the new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, is, and in his like challenge to really try and create real rates, you know, that is positive for the dollar as well. So we're sitting in an environment where potentially, hopefully, there's a peace deal on the cards. Hopefully, oil can start to move through the Strait of Hormuz and supply chains can start to reopen. And if that is the case, then that'll be very positive, I say, for equity markets and for interest rates and for inflation and hopefully for the dollar as well.
Speaking of Kevin Warsh, Victoria, we got the unfortunate news, of course, that the former Fed chair, Alan Greenspan, passed away, sadly, at the age of 100. He was one of the most prolific Fed chairs, often referred to as the maestro, for those that don't know. I want to get your thoughts on his approach, obviously in a very, very different time as Fed chair, but running through his tenure until 2006, and compare that to where Kevin Warsh finds the Fed today after the resignation of Jerome Powell. Where do you think, from a policy perspective, the US Fed sits at the moment, and how would that likely influence markets?
Yes, it's such an interesting topic. So, yeah, rest in peace, Alan Greenspan, 100 years old, a very controversial figure. I mean, one of the greatest, but as I say, most contentious figures in modern economic history. And I think his legacy will be debated for years and years to come. So he served 5 terms as Fed chairman. I mean, that is over 18 years, all the way from Ronald Reagan up to George W. Bush. So he's the second longest Fed chair in history. And what he became famous for, or should I say infamous for, was creating what it was known as the Greenspan put, which was basically the Fed stepping in to rescue markets and cut rates when things got tough. But this created a bit of a moral hazard, and he was criticized for it. So despite the fact that under his term, markets did incredibly well, he was criticized because what happened was that, in essence, this moral hazard is this concept of reckless behavior, i.e. like, you know, actors believing they're going to get bailed out even if they behave very badly. So there's no consequence for your actions. And so, you know, what we're seeing now under Kevin Warsh is a very different stance. It's almost, it's hawkish, as he's saying he's going to protect inflation more than markets. And what you're seeing is the markets don't really like that. And that's a lot of what's really happening today. Well, not today, just over the last few weeks, when you've seen Kevin Warsh come out and say, we're not cutting rates, despite the political pressure coming from Trump, and despite the fact that oil prices look like they are lower, and as I say, oil might start flowing. So we might be in for a very different term under this new Fed chair.
Victoria, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the oil price, $76 a barrel there, best level we've seen since the conflicts have effectively started, and potentially the best level we could see all year. If we are to see an end to the conflict, we could come sub 75. I know that's very optimistic at this stage, but the market wanting to believe in that optimism as well. What does that do for the second half of the year? We're almost halfway through the year. This has been pretty much the only thing we've spoken about since the start of the year, and it's really done a number on returns, on markets, on market outlook. Where do we land if we do break below that $75 a barrel level and we do get a better second half of the year? Or is it a better second half?
Well, yeah, I had a fabulous economics tutor at varsity who had this deep accent, and she used to say, prices are sticky downwards. And I think what you're going to see is that even when prices come down, the pain from the fallout will not be resolved as quickly. And I want listeners to cast their mind back to post-COVID, when suddenly supply chains, everything was back to up and running, but supply chain disruptions take longer to actually come through and prices going downwards. And I think what we're going to see is that actually a lot of people will potentially keep the benefit of a lower oil price. So yes, it is much more positive. We definitely want a lower oil price. And also remember, in 2008, when oil was 130, the petrol price was half of what it is now. So it's not as elastic as one thinks on the downside. So a lower oil price, definitely positive. We want supply chains to move. We want fertilizer prices to come down. We want oil prices, which feed into absolutely everything, to come down. But I think the expectation of it snapping back to where we were in January from a price perspective is a bit optimistic. So at this stage, the balance of risk still points towards slightly higher inflation, but the direction of travel is positive.
The direction of travel is positive. Markets are trending in the right direction. They just need to keep trending in the right direction if we are to have a better second half of the year. We clearly know that we are quite exhausted from all the market movements up to this point in the year, and we are still, again, only halfway through the year. We'll see how the rest of the year and the rest of the week indeed shapes up. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Marketing Director at WealthStrat, Victoria Ruvers, joining us to share her thoughts on markets and some of the driving factors behind them.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The latest consumer confidence index was released today, and it points to South Africans being nervous around the Middle East tensions and the state of the South African economy, amongst other things. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with independent economist John Lewis. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of the data. John, lovely having you on our show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The inflation print from a South African perspective coming in at 4.5%, the most recent print. Let's perhaps start the conversation there. That not doing much to boost consumer confidence. I imagine that was not the only number that was taken into consideration here, but consumer confidence levels definitely not at their best if we're looking at where they are at the moment.
No, look, Jimmy, even in the first quarter before the outbreak of the Iran conflict at -7, it wasn't a strong consumer confidence figure, but at -19 in the second quarter, a lot weaker. Yeah, there was the direct impact of petrol prices and the big rise as a result of the war around Iran and the Strait of Hormuz and the oil price surge. And that's fed through into general inflation, taking it from nearer to 3% up to 4.5% quite quickly. That eats into disposable income. But what it also does, at the time of the survey, many respondents may not yet have experienced the interest rate hike, but the fears of the interest rate hike and the talk of the interest rate hike was already there well before the Reserve Bank hiked at the end of last month. So that's the next obvious fear for consumers when inflation surges, is when are interest rates going to go up? So yeah, all in all, much of the deterioration in consumer confidence, I think, has to do with the whole Iran conflict and the surge in oil and fuel prices.
John, let's take a look at the South African story in a bit more detail, zooming in on that inflation print. Our inflation levels, for all that we've gone through, even through the COVID-19 pandemic, not exceeding the 7, 8 or 9% levels. We're back at 4.5%, which in the old framework would have been exactly where we want to be from a midpoint perspective. We know we've revised that midpoint down, or the ideal target down, to 3%. At 4.5%, are we really that concerned around the state of our inflation and how it's going to filter into the market?
No, look, I don't think it's an inflation shock. That's for sure. I think we could go up to slightly above 5% before all is said and done. But with fuel prices now coming off and looking like we're heading towards some sort of resolution of the conflict in the Middle East, after next month's interest rate meeting, where I think the Reserve Bank might hike one more time, we're looking at probably an improving inflation situation not too far from now. So no, I don't think it's a serious, it's a major inflation shock. But I think what we need to bear in mind is that many South Africans, especially on the lower income side, cannot take an awful amount of inflation because unemployment is high as it is, and incomes have been under pressure for quite some time. The economy has been relatively stagnant for quite some years. So it doesn't take much to cause consumer confidence to deteriorate. A bit of inflation, an interest rate hike or two, and suddenly many South Africans are under pressure quite quickly.
John, if we think about the confidence levels at the moment from a South African perspective, and you touched on the fact that unemployment is a factor here, and we start to compare our economy against other global economies. Yes, we've seen a positive ratings upgrade from the ratings agencies, but without economic growth, none of these conversations effectively mean anything for the consumer and for the average South African, because the economic growth is where the jobs are created, is where the standard of living is improved. How do we start to balance or at least reconcile consumer confidence with what should be economic growth with what is economic growth?
Well, I think the consumer is probably going to be in a weak confidence situation for a few years, because while we are making the structural reforms slowly, and by that I mean government has taken steps to fix electricity supply. It's a lot better than a few years ago. Now there's efforts to fix the Transnet part of the economy, the ports and the logistics. So there are moves afoot to start reforming the economy. But those structural reforms will probably take some years before the impacts are felt. And what government does need to do, it's still got a very weak infrastructure budget, a CapEx budget. That needs to be lifted. It's some years before we see noticeable upgrades in general infrastructure in the country. So while the thinking is starting to go in the right direction, and that is what the ratings agencies will be seeing, it will take some time before it feeds through en masse to the consumer, to the household sector of the economy, in terms of significantly higher employment and income numbers.
John, before I let you go, I want to take a look at some of the external factors that could potentially dampen consumer confidence. We know that the deterioration has been largely due to some of the pressures that consumers have been under, and part of those pressures have included conversations like VAT increases, and we know that at this point we are itching closer to a midterm budget policy statement that has promised a fiscal anchor, amongst other things. Where do consumers need relief from the government, from the external parties, and where do consumers not need added pressure?
Well, I think the relief that consumers need is probably indirect. It's by those structural reforms to get this economy growing far faster and creating far more jobs. That's really where it has to go. It's not up to government to directly provide income and directly provide a lot of relief for consumers. It can provide relief with better economic policy that makes job creation grow faster. But there are some areas where I think consumers are desire relief, and that's in terms of at local government level, the municipal rates and tariff increases that continue at rapid rates well above inflation. There, I think it needs to come to land at some point before electricity costs become almost prohibitive. So there are areas of government which is driving inflation well above the overall inflation rate, where you would hope that at some point these rates would moderate to back in line with the low inflation levels. And then infrastructure, as I say, I think that's where confidence can be boosted dramatically. I think there's nothing better than if consumers, households look around and start seeing roads repaired, besides in electricity supply doing better, service delivery in general doing better, and a lot of infrastructure being upgraded. We're some way away from noticeable impacts on infrastructure, but I think that's where you can see you can provide the fertilizer for far greater consumer confidence. Having said that, I do think that once this conflict is over and petrol prices start to go down, which they may well do next month, I think consumer confidence could improve in the third quarter somewhat from the minus 19, probably still a negative value. But I think this conflict looks like it's not going to be around for too much longer.
Consumer confidence in desperate need of a boost and a restoration. We will see whether that comes through. For now, though, we will have to hold on to the fact that the economy is in dire need of assistance and we are on the right track, but we could definitely be moving at a much faster pace. Independent economist John Lewis joining us to take a look at consumer confidence in South Africa and where we go to from here.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm at Land of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for.
Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, the Consumer Confidence Index is not the only indicator that we look at when looking at the growth prospects of a country and even of the world. We're going to be taking a look at the economic outlook of South Africa and indeed of the rest of the world, because some of the smartest minds in South Africa, being some of the leading economists that we have in South Africa, have all banded together in collaboration with the Bureau for Market Research and UNISA to enter the Economist of the Year competition. And alongside that, they've all revised their growth prospects for South Africa and for the world. We're going to take a look at this in a bit more detail with the CEO of the Bureau for Market Research, Professor Dion Tustin. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of it. Lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Growth prospects halfway through the year, certainly not where we thought they would be at the start of the year, but a lot has happened during the year.
No, and good evening, Jimmy, and thank you for inviting me to the conversation this afternoon or this evening. Most certainly so. I think at the start of 2026, the so-called crystal ball used by the South African leading economist reflected a much more favorable economic outlook when we look at the latest predictions, where growth was initially expected to reach around 1.6%. It's now much lower, and inflation forecasts were at 3.4, now at 4.1, and even interest rates appearing likely to remain lower, and employment growth being expected to strengthen at the start of the year. Now, however, once again, the geopolitical tensions intensified in the meantime, and a huge uncertainty spreading through the global economic markets, with the image of the crystal ball changing the perceptions of these economists. It's almost like venom from the geopolitical instability beginning to spread through the global economy via, among others, your oil prices, your rising inflation expectations, and also then the increased financial market uncertainty that's also visible in these projections. And as a result, the economists has adjusted their forecast to reflect a more changing economic reality, much lower as compared to the start of the year.
Prof, I'm having a look at some of the key indicators that economists typically look at, things around real GDP growth, CPI, the prime interest rate, the price of Brent crude, as you alluded to. And if I'm looking at just how these numbers have been trending, at least for the last 2 or 3 months, it seems as though there's very little to be positive about, other than potentially a slightly firmer and a slightly stronger rand, even if today isn't reflective of that. But if we look at just the trends throughout the first 6 months of the year, first quarter, even second quarter, economists have a lot to be concerned about, not just locally, but internationally as well, it seems.
Most certainly. I think you're referring to the growth rate, the economic growth rate, down from the 1.3 to 1.2 in the last month. Your growth rate in the number of people being employed, down from 0.8% to 0.7%. And then on the upper end of the projections, your consumer inflation, from earlier predictions of well below 3, now running into the 3.9 and the latest 4.1%. And even expectations where I think there were a lot of optimism at the start of the year of the prime interest rates being either then coming down, the predictions of the economists now show a 10.3% to a 10.5% increase, which is slightly higher than the prime interest rate that they have predicted at the start of the year. And this is, although it looks like a small percentage change, it can have a quite significant impact. Because if you simply just look at the revision of the 1.6 in economic growth in February to 1.2 in May, this implies that approximately about 31 billion less expected economic activity could happen this year. And even with employment growth forecast declining from 1 to 0.7, could potentially result in more than 50,000 fewer jobs than previously anticipated. And at the same time, your inflation expectations rising, as I said, from 3.4 to 4, while your interest rate expectations are also increasing from 9.8 to 10.5. So I think really the economic road ahead might look getting more bumpier than earlier in the year predicted, yes.
Speaking of that bumpy road, Prof, I want to get your thoughts on where that puts us from a planning perspective. I mean, many economists that are part of this research, part of gathering this information, beyond wanting to be right and wanting to be the economist of the year, the underlying factors that we're looking at speak to something that goes beyond just the sport of entering a lighthearted competition. We are battling serious issues locally, internationally, and this affects everything from how investors see the markets to how it is that we start to think about future growth conversations. Where are some of the serious concerns and perhaps some of the commonalities that we're seeing between our market and perhaps global markets?
Yeah, no, I think what you're referring to specifically is the impact can be on employment and business, specifically looking at businesses which are becoming more cautious. Consumer and business confidence are dropping, and greater uncertainty often results in that delayed investment decisions, slow expansion plans, and reducing, especially then, hiring or labor activity. And as I said, that already reflects in the employment forecast being downgraded, and with a number of jobs, fewer jobs that will be created than previously. So for business planning, this information is critical, but I don't think just from a business perspective, but also the impact on households. Consumers are likely to experience the effects through higher inflation and your higher interest rates, as I mentioned earlier. And as your inflation expectations rise and your interest rates then also tend to increase gradually as well. And the faster or the latest forecast shows that even your prime lending could increase from 9.8 to 10%. And especially those middle and higher, middle and lower income households will will be placed under additional pressure this year, especially those households with mortgages, vehicle finance, and other forms of debt. So it's not just the businesses that needs planning around this, but also households that needs to follow these trends very closely to do their own personal planning as well.
Certainly a lot of planning needed, not just from a global perspective, but right down through to a household level, especially with how volatile and uncertain times are. Global outlooks being revised on the continuous basis, and that not boding well at the moment. Of course, this can always change to the upside if the conditions affecting these global revisions start to look better. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Executive Officer of the Bureau for Market Research, Prof. Dion Tustin, for joining us to share his thoughts around what seems to be having economists concerned as they look at the first half of the year and look ahead to the second half.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So Spanish airline Air Europa has informed us that they would be looking to begin and launch a new long-haul international flight from Johannesburg to Madrid. This is certainly going to do wonders for our tourism sector, but it also now means we have yet another new direct flight into Europe. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with our aviation expert, Dr. Guy Leach. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Dr. Leach, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The last time you and I spoke, we were taking a look at the state of aviation on the African continent, and this sort of announcement is just the kind of announcement you want to hear if you're looking to broaden the appeal for African aviation into the global landscape.
Very much so. You know, in fact, what is even more sort of, in a sense, satisfactory is that they're coming into Joburg and not Cape Town, because Cape Town has run an incredibly successful operation to attract people to fly directly to Cape Town and bypass Joburg. So it's really nice to see a new airline starting to fly into Johannesburg direct. And of course, it's really great. I mean, every cent spent on tourism is a huge boost for our economy, because it's got a multiplier of as much as 30 into the broader economy. So having a new direct flight into Europe, especially one that's slightly shorter than the normal routes into Europe via, say, Heathrow in New England or via Germany, Frankfurt, is also a really nice feature. Look, at this stage, They're operating a relatively mid-sized aircraft, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, and they're only operating 3 days, three flights a week. But, you know, it's a great start.
Guy, when we look at the actual route, you touched on the fact that they're only operating three flights at the moment in the week. They're operating smaller aircraft, but nevertheless, this is a positive step in the right direction. If we look at long-haul flights in isolation, we know that at some point SAA used to be the biggest airline on the African continent. They used to also do long-haul flights into the likes of South America. They're trying to bring some of those back. But what do long-haul flights do from an aviation perspective versus connecting flights? What's their strategic advantage?
That's a fantastic question, because it goes straight to the heart of the dilemma of aviation planners, and that is whether to do what is called a point-to-point model or a hub-and-spoke model. Point-to-point flying means that you've often got smaller aircraft flying from relatively smaller destinations, connecting smaller destinations with direct flights. The hub-and-spoke means that you fly to a hub, and then you fly another connecting flight somewhere else. Well, unfortunately for passengers, I think that the hub-and-spoke model has become the dominant mode, and that's why we've seen the fantastic growth of places like Dubai and in Africa now, Addis Ababa and even Nairobi. And it's because the people would prefer to link through another destination, get flights which they can book on one ticket through code-sharing arrangements that might include two or three different airlines, that the hub-and-spoke model has become absolutely central, and this has required what we call interlining or code-share agreements, which make it that much easier to book multiple flights on a single ticket.
Guy, can we take a look at the economic benefit of introducing this long-haul flight? We know from a South African perspective, there might not be a significant demand of South Africans wanting to particularly go to Madrid, but connecting into a key point like such as Madrid, connecting into the European continent, does have almost mutual benefit for South African travellers as well as European travellers.
Very much so, especially because Heathrow's got a whole lot more difficult with transit visas as well. And more importantly, there's an increasing South African presence in the Iberian Peninsula, in Spain, and in particular in Portugal. Portugal, as we may know, has been attracting South African investors with the Golden Visa program. So the linkages are growing all the time. And in fact, I'm relatively optimistic that Air Europa will probably soon expand us onto a daily flight, and then perhaps even more. More frequently, and that's great, simply because the reality is that we really do need to make sure that we can connect to all points of Europe. In the bad old days of SAA, it used to fly to the most extraordinary places. You could fly to Manchester, you could fly to Athens, you could fly to Rome, you could fly to Tel Aviv. That sort of connectivity has unfortunately gone because of the rise of the hub-and-spoke model. By the way, I just need to point out that long-haul flying has also become absolutely transformed. We're now seeing these ultra-long-haul flights, and that is particularly the so-called sunrise flights, where they're now managing to connect Sydney direct to London, and that's absolutely extraordinary. It's almost halfway around the world. That's because airliners have advanced so much in the latest generation. They've got so much residual or spare power that they can lift enough fuel to fly for 20 hours nonstop. And that's completely changing the way people fly. But I don't think that a lot of people will be quite happy to hop on an airliner for 20 hours rather than have to face the stresses and the strains of having to connect through a hub somewhere else. But it's a model that's unfolding again. But from my point of view, I'm very pleased to see a return, at least from the Air Europa perspective, to point-to-point flying.
Guy, before I let you go, I want to take a look at that hub-and-spoke model and look at it in the context of South Africa. With the increased popularity that we're seeing South Africa enjoy from international destinations, could we be looking at South Africa becoming its own hub of sorts, not just for the African continent, but perhaps from a travel perspective globally?
I'd love to see that, but I'm not optimistic. The reality is that Africa is at the end of a spoke. Or rather, South Africa is at the end of a spoke. There's very little connectivity that we can do beyond, you know, not many people are going to travel from South Africa to Antarctica, for instance. Yes, we do manage to connect South America to Australia, but again, it's not a very busy route. So the problem we have is feeding and defeeding routes. And that is why this interlining agreement is particularly significant, because once passengers arrive in South Africa on a Air Europa flight, they will almost certainly want to connect somewhere else. And it makes a lot of sense for them to connect with a regional carrier like SAMAIR, which flies to, I think, over 50 destinations around Southern Africa and can connect them to places, you know, as small as Plettenberg Bay. And that's really what it's all about. So it creates an ability for Air Europa to feed its routes from the south, which is the tricky part, and it enables SAMAIR to feed all its flights with people coming in from Spain.
A new route increasing connectivity between South Africa and the rest of the world, and that connectivity couldn't have come at a better time, according to the gentleman who probably might be the only gentleman that I know that holds a PhD in African airline connectivity, Dr. Guy Leach, our aviation expert, joining us to take a look at the new route announced by Air Europa connecting Johannesburg to Madrid.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
I don't know about you, but I've often wondered what would I do if I had 8.2 million rand sitting in a bank account. Apparently there are individuals out there that have 8.2 million rand sitting in a bank account, and they've decided that that money is best spent on what is known as a Wimbledon debenture. Quite an interesting piece of financial engineering, a financial instrument that effectively was born in a 2024 that allows the holder of the debenture access to centre court tickets at arguably the biggest tennis event of our lifetimes. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with founder at Africa Sports Unified, Gabriel Ajale, joins me on the line from the UK to see if we can make sense of this and see what all the hype is about here. Gabriel, lovely having you on our show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Wimbledon has begun officially yesterday, probably the biggest of the Grand Slams, and amidst all of this, seemingly the popularity there isn't ending, such that we now have new investment cases here.
Yeah, 100%. As you said, Wimbledon is probably the biggest of the Grand Slam tournaments, and demand seems to continually increase year on year. I think that's down to the models that they have in place, of course. Wimbledon is based on history and prestige, but also there's an aspect of scarcity. So in terms of the hot tickets in the town, but not many of them are available. So I think that drives demand and prices moving forward.
Gabriel, let's take a look at that scarcity and that demand in a bit more detail. The debentures that were launched back in April of 2024 initially launched at a fraction of what they're retailing at the moment. The product itself, linking a financial instrument with seats that are valid for a five-year period from this year. And we know how difficult it is to get access to Centre Court, to Wimbledon, throughout this particular time. But these seats not only being something that drives the prestige and the scarcity element that you mentioned, but clearly an investment case because they have a resale value in the market.
Yeah, 100%. I think we're seeing a slight change of model as well. But even to your point about the resale in the market, so even just doing some numbers, it's kind of tripled in terms of the pricing. So they're roughly going around for $380,000 on resale. And that's just incredible considering when they came in and the increase in price that it's had in this moment in time. And I think this is showing, I guess, instances of slight change of market, people not just paying for, paying for live entertainment. And the prestige of being there in a world where sports and entertainment has become like a prestige or high-end form of leisure. I think that's why we're seeing some of these increase in prices, and that's reflecting what's happening in Wimbledon.
Gabriel, I want to compare this with perhaps what we're seeing in the FIFA World Cup. We know, of course, that hydration breaks are all the rage in this year's World Cup, with estimates ranging from anywhere between just under $1 billion to just over $1 billion over the course of the World Cup. Over, I think it's about 208 hydration breaks. The Wimbledon model with the debenture structure, clearly very, very different, and intentionally so. If we're looking at the business models that drive these sporting events, how do organizers, perhaps even asset managers in this case, start to think about their role, or perhaps leveraging the sporting side of it with the business and the commercial side?
Yeah, it's a good point, especially regarding asset managers. So like with any, I guess, asset or commodity, you look to get in, and ideally you would love to see your asset price increase over time. And we've definitely seen that with Wimbledon. I don't think Wimbledon has reached its peak yet, where maybe prices will start to plateau or even come down. I think we'll continue to see debentures continue to rise. So for example, for private equity firms, asset managers, this is an asset class, not just to Wimbledon, but to move other sports and entertainment assets, to get in early and invest in the commodity and see it grow and invest, grow and increase long term. Of course, there's other factors to this. I've mentioned in terms of the scarcity for Wimbledon, there's very limited amount of tickets, never just for Wimbledon, but for Centre Court. We obviously cannot look away from the actual quality of the players on the court. I know the days of Nadal and Federer have ended, but we've got Alcaraz, we've got Sinner, Djokovic even to an extent as well. So people are paying those premium prices for an asset class that goes up. And of course, Wimbledon has probably the most partnerships and commercial deals, the most generated revenue of all the Grand Slams. So that adds to it all. And I guess in terms of your comparison to the hydration breaks in FIFA at the World Cup, I think generally we're seeing further commercialization of sports. In tennis, it's a bit more common, even though players naturally deserve the breaks because they're playing in hot climates across the globe. I think with FIFA, especially being in America, they've perhaps seen an opportunity to further commercialize and generate revenue. Now, I'm not sure if that would be, will become commonplace in football across the globe. But it's interesting to see how FIFA have introduced it, and also the appetite of, from spectators and people in the media like yourselves, how to take the opportunity to, get further sponsorship models, commercial agreements.
Gabriel, do you think that the commercialization of sport is potentially an alternative from an investment point of view to hedge against geopolitical risks? I mean, we're looking at things like the US-Iran conflicts, the wars that have been going on throughout the world. That has had a dampener on equity markets. This is a completely different asset class, a completely different way of thinking about investments. Do you think perhaps that this starts to become popular, not because it's sports related per se, but also partly because it hedges investors against other market risks?
Potentially, I think so. But we've done a piece on this recently. I think in the geopolitical landscape that we are in, yes, sports is maybe slightly different, but it's still susceptible to these geopolitical shifts that we've seen. As you're talking about the World Cup, we've seen a lot of instances, need I say less, regarding politics being involved in football, for example. So I think they're probably looking, I think it's an asset class that can be looked at for different reasons and not so much just because of the geopolitical landscape that we're currently in.
And I suppose there is always that aspect that you get to enjoy your investment along the way. Gabriel, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on perhaps what a debenture like the Wimbledon debenture does for how it is that we structure these investments. We now have a clearer idea that it's not the traditional way of investing that we've looked at. We just alluded to the fact that it might not be for the same traditional reasons, but it also doesn't have to look like the traditional investment case. We've seen the rise of the likes of Polymarket that have just structured a deal with the Bundesliga. That is a completely different side of investment and taking a view on a market. This potentially setting the tone for what we could look at in future.
Yeah, and I think there's common traits that we can see with quite a few of these. When there's scarcity, when there's prestige, tradable rights really converge and you get huge value creation. I think this is definitely a blueprint for hedge funds, PEs, private equity firms as well, and other asset managers globally, but especially in Africa, to perhaps look at tournaments and federations and think about premium asset models and how that can grow and move forward. In the global landscape, we're seeing a lot more entries into the sporting environment. Yes, in terms of federations and sports, but also players and academies and ownership. So I think we'll see that. But like I said, the commonality is investing in things that have an appreciation value going up moving forward.
Certainly some interesting things to learn, and perhaps this would have been very useful to bear in mind at the time we were looking at things called non-fungible tokens. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note, though. Thanks so much to founder at Africa Sports Unified, Gabriel Jala, for joining us to share his thoughts on the Wimbledon debentures that have almost tripled in value in under 3 years.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Property Tuesday, and we are taking a look at home improvements and the growth in the design landscape. Certainly an interesting trend has been emerging in the property space. We're going to take a look at this in a bit more detail with the new business development manager at Tiletoria, Andre Deacher. He joins me on the line now to see if we can make sense of this. Andre, lovely having you on our show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Home improvements at some point were a nice to have. In some cases, they were a good addition to increase property value, but it seems more and more that they're now becoming a part of almost expressing your character and your personality as a homeowner.
Yes, Jimmy, thank you for your time and thank you for having us. Now, that's definitely the case, and we're experiencing that at Tiletoria as well. Over the years that we've been in the tile business or the building industry business, as a matter of fact, we've seen the changes coming through, and more the customer walking through our doors are much more informed and have done much more homework and background checks on how to improve their house and making it part of their, you know, the design is more and more coming, the aesthetics as such is more and more becoming part of the whole home improvement than just, you know, renovating a home or renovating a bathroom or whatever the case may be.
Andre, I remember a time where, depending on the personalization and customization afforded to things, not just in the property landscape, but anywhere, whether it was furniture, the more something was customized and the more unique it was, the more difficult it became to resell. Unless, of course, you were a gentleman named Michael Jackson, in which case you could sell anything in the world. But is that still the case from a property perspective? I mean, with some of the improvements that we're seeing, is there still the sense of there are safe improvements, and then you've perhaps gone a little too custom in your improvements?
Jimmy, I think there's always the risk of going too custom, because your taste and my taste might be totally different in the end of the day, if you would like to sell that property or get your money back for that investment that you've done. But the reality is that, you know, through our trends and through our designs and talking to our customers and getting to the space, and we'll talk about SpecLab a bit later, but that's exactly getting to the customer to understand that trend and to understand that, you know, not making it too personalized because of the concern that you might have the issue down the line should you would like to get rid or sell that property in the end of the day. So I think it's a combination of, you know, sticking to the trends or staying with the trends rather, and not over committing to personalized taste maybe in the end of the day.
Andre, how do you strike that balance? If you are interested in preserving the value of the property whilst at the same time adding that uniquely personal touch, what are some of the good property habits to adopt in this case? Do we look at interior adjustments? Do we look at exterior adjustments? Is there even a formula here?
Jimmy, I'm not a property expert, so I'm not sure what's the right formula, but obviously being in the, on the inside, outside of the business, because TALS, you know, our game is an internal and an external application. So I think there is a fair balance in the end of the day from any consumer's point of view that, you know, if you overspend or overextend on the inside and do nothing on the outside, that won't be an attraction to a possible investor or buyer. And I think it's a fine balance between the two in the end of the day. I used to know people in the property industry that always said, you know, if you want to sell a house, make sure the kitchen looks fine and then the house is sold. Or make sure that you boil, cook some nice food, nice smelling food when the potential customer walks in or buyer walks in. But I think in the end of the day, it's that fine balance in getting that upgrade or that renovation on a balanced based of exterior and interior. And obviously a large part is interior, or large of the most more expensive part these days, especially is on the interior side, yes.
Andre, let's take a look at that interior and take a look at the personalization of that. I mean, many people often look for some uniqueness to add to a home, but we often overlook the tile aspect. And if you think about it, a tile kind of covers most of the floor space in a home. How personal can we get here?
Well, Jimmy, floor and in some cases, to you know, especially on the large format, which we are big in tiles format these days, this can be a lot of wall space as well. So, and I think you can definitely get quite personal, because if you look at the trends going around, and we try to keep up with the international trends as well, it's more towards warmer tones, natural colors, you know, more to the big format type of thing. So, and I think in the end of the day, if we sit down a customer and we sit down with the interior designer or whatever and his customer, we try to assist them with finding that right space or the right exact balance between personal preference and what is the trend type of things going. And we seem to have a right, find the right way to do that and to get that across to our customers in the end of the day.
Andre, before I let you go, should every trend be followed? We live in a society where trends are constantly emerging and things like property, a much longer term investment and a much longer term decision. Even if you are putting in new wall tiles, those wall tiles are going to be around for quite some time. Should we be approaching home improvements from a trend perspective, or is it important to bear in mind that some trends might not last, but some long term decisions might?
Jimmy, you're correct. The some long-term decisions might definitely, but the trends, and I think that's the nice part about, you know, we talk to our customers always from a point of an investment point of view. If they look at redoing tiles or putting in tiles, you know, it's a 5 to a 10-year to a 15-year investment, depending on the type of customer and the type of client you're looking at. So it's definitely a balance that you have to look in the end of the day. The nice part from a sales perspective is obviously that you can tell the customer, well, if you don't like it after 5 years, you can change it again and keep up with the trends. And we actually see that a lot, especially on homeowners, where they, you know, they might not change the whole layout of the house or the whole tiling of the house, but they might change the bathroom aesthetics of the bathroom tiles, the feel and the look and the touch, or maybe just in the living room area, and doing that part by part, going up. Part of our spec lab and our growth strategy is exactly that, to look at those type of things and sitting down with the customer, interior designer, architect, and finding that correct space in our spec lab showrooms and giving him the space where he can actually sit and play around with those different, all those different factors before he makes his decision or her make her decision in the end of the day.
Home improvements can be deeply personal, they can be customized, but it's important to remember that along the way, your design specifications need to make economic sense. Perhaps if you're looking at that investment property and wondering how it is that you can add a little bit of personality to it, we'll have to leave the conversation on that note. New business development manager Tal Toria, Andre Deyachar, joining us to share his thoughts on home improvements and the growing trend of personalization and design specifications.
The Property Pod, hosted by me, Suren Naidu, is South Africa's premier property investor podcast. On this weekly MoneyWeb show, we gain insider insights from leading executives, analysts, developers, and entrepreneurs in the country's dynamic real estate sector. The podcast features diverse guests and offers in-depth coverage on the South African property scene, also featuring as a video on MoneyWeb TV on YouTube. Listen to the Property Pod weekly on moneyweb.co.za, podcast platforms like Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcast for the latest industry insights and developments.
That's the update for today, folks. If you've missed the conversations, you know we can catch up on them. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Hurst is standing by with the latest round of evening news. Michael Abramson will follow with the latest in top sport. So from my side, good night.